Part 3. People. Chapter 9. Sacrifice. If I had been here 10,000 years ago, after the glaciers melted, I could have done what I do today, raking the sand on the ebb for cockles, searching the lowest of the tide for the telltale dimples of the razor clams, picking mussels at the mouth of the big burn where it falls from between the alders onto the foreshore, collecting a plateful of sand eels caught just out of their burrows by the dropping sea. I would have whooped with delight, as we still do now from time to time, when crowds and crowds of herring fry land on the boulders at the edge of the beach, driven ashore by the mackerel, the prey fish fizzing and jumping all over the surface of the water, hazing the skin of it, and coming to lie dead and glittering in the drying pools among the wrack, a sudden, crazed silver bullion, a protein feast from nothing in the ochre of the weed. These were the riches to be had on this edible shore, but for a full 100 generations, no one came. For spring after spring, summer after summer, for more than 3,000 years, no one was here. People were living in England, as far north as York, hunter-gathering in the marshes and oak woods of a pristine country, but no nearer. They fished down there in lakes and rivers, hunted and killed deer and aurochs, feeding largely off that huge reservoir of herbivore protein, and feeling no need to come further north or west, up into the moors and mountains. In the northern temperate zones of America and Eurasia, for a hunter-gathering life in an untouched country, every person needs about 15,000 acres. In England, by about 5,500 BC, with the growth in the population and diminishing quantities of wild meat, that limit had been reached, and the long drive to recolonize the country could begin again. The world was warming, fewer storms, gentler winters, and people at last began to make their way up towards the maritime riches of the west coast of Scotland. On one headland and island after another, up and down the Atlantic shore, these Mesolithic people, so called from the Middle Stone Age, between the Paleolithic and the Neolithic, named after their neat, slight tools made of slivers of flint, left behind them the earliest human monuments in Europe, huge piles of used seashell gathered above the shores from which they had picked them. There was one just north of Morven, in Loch Sunart, on the tiny uninhabited island of Risca, a bony place now almost inaccessible in summer and blanketed in bracken, but where, in 1920 to 1921, a large collection was discovered of stone mattocks, antler harpoons and limpet hammers, fist-sized stone truncheons for smacking limpets off the rocks, all abandoned next to a vast quantity of mollusk shells, fish bones, lobster and crab shell, and the bones of seabirds, seals, otters and porpoises. The techniques of the 1920s archaeologists were clumsy by modern standards, and most of the detailed information has been lost. I have looked for the remains of the midden on Risca, landing there one sultry summer day, but there is nothing to be seen, at least on the surface. Other more recent investigations have examined these limpet middens more carefully, sieving every last fragment from the dust, and finding all the shore animals on which the peoples here preyed 7,000 years ago, limpets and keyhole limpets, cockles, periwinkles and smooth winkles, oysters, mussels, scallops, queen scallops, cowries, often perforated and used as beads and in necklaces, the ridges and twirls of nassarius shells and top shells. Some of the bigger shells, from razor clams and the scallops, are often reshaped as scrapers. The claws and legs of edible, velvet, swimming and shore crabs, plus the vertebrae and skull parts of bream, wrasse, gilthead, hake, pollock, cod and taupe, a small shark, are often mixed in this astonishing fruit de mer with products of the land, apple pips, plum stones and the shells from hazelnuts, along with the occasional bones of a hare or a goat, Often with them, most poignantly, are the skeletons and skulls of the great orcs still then thriving on the European littoral. This Mesolithic intimacy with the intertidal was total. Analyses of the bone collagen of the people who made the middens have revealed in bone after bone that virtually all the protein on which these coastal dwellers lived came from the sea – birds, fish, seals, the occasional cast-up whale or dolphin. Unlike their immediate ancestors, deer or wild cattle were nearly absent from their diet. To the sea vertebrates, they now added the resources of the shore and its pools. Nothing of their equipment survives in Scotland, but elsewhere, in wet or drowned landscapes, Mesolithic logboats, along with wooden fish traps, baskets, string, nets, floats, weights, fish hooks, and the ability to tie good, quick and useful knots, have all been found. These were the sea people, the sea almost literally in every pore of their bodies, the sea margin more important to them than anyone before or since in the long European story. One set of middens on the pale, grassy, tidal island of Oronsay, the far side of Mull, has revealed that these piles of shells were more than mere rubbish tips. Because fish are cold-blooded, they grow fast in the warm water months of the year, more slowly in the winter. If you look carefully at their bones, you can read the annual pattern of rapid translucent summer growth and thicker winter growth patterned through them like the rings in a timber tree. The last and outer ring in any fish will record the time it was caught. Analysis of the ear bones of the young seythe picked out on the Oronsay mounds has shown that as the year progressed, the people moved from one corner of the little island to the next, each shell mound made next to a hearth and a simple shelter, little more than a windbreak, containing the fish in turn from spring, summer, autumn and early winter. Only the winter itself, when the young seythe move offshore, inaccessible to the baited hooks and hand nets of the Mesolithic people, was without a catch. Instead, the winter was the time, above all at low tide, when they harvested the limpets from the rocks. For about 300 years, just over 5,000 years ago, each mound in turn received the same seasonal addition of shell and fishbone. One cold and windy afternoon, I walked across the Macha of Oronsay with Sarah and the children, wandering from one of these grassy knolls to the next, some still 30 feet high, thinking of the people 5,000 years ago, next to this same eye-blue sea, with the same white beaches and the skyline of the Paps in Jura to the south. Each party of shell-gatherers would have come to the old familiar summer place, or spring place, or autumn place, and begun to add to what they and their parents and grandparents had gathered there before. They can only have viewed their slowly grassing middens, as we do our summer and winter haunts, as marks of time, a way of calibrating the world, each yearly arrival, a resummoning of the seasons we have had there before. For all of us, these places are memory pools, with the past embedded in them, full of the pleasures of renewal, the consolations of continuity, and the sense of loss in time. The archaeologists, led by Paul Mellers from Cambridge, found one other intriguing phenomenon in the mounds. They were full of human hand and foot bones, at least 70 of them. Most were scattered almost at random through the mass of limpet shell, and from all sorts of people, women, children, young and old men. There are no cut marks or other evidence of cannibalism. Many of the bones showed that the hands of which they had once been a part were heavily muscled, working tools, the instruments of survival. One of them, almost complete, was laid next to and aligned with the flipper of a grey seal, of which many come ashore here in the autumn to pup. Finger to finger in the midst of the mound, the two species very nearly touched. A quiet mystery floods in behind that signature of a purposive cultural act, as the archaeologists austerely describe it. What can it mean? Had the hand belonged to a great seal hunter, Were all these hand bones somehow a memorial to the engagement in the realities of the world that a well-led life involves? Did the seal-touching hand belong to a man who had his hand in, who had a hand in everything this small island community needed, who handed it on to his successors, in whose hands they had felt safe and good? And whose hands were no good now? Who had moved over towards the half-hidden sea world in which those close and sentient sea companions, whenever one looks up, are found afloat and bristling, aware of us, looking to us just offshore? There is no answer to any of that, but it does bring to mind a man I know in the Hebrides, a fisherman whose hands are the biggest and strongest I have ever known. When he greets you, your hands disappear inside the grip of his, which are scarred, knobbled and muscled with decades of work on the decks of herring drifters and scallop boats. Quantities of Donald McSween's existence are folded into his magnificent hands, and it may be that the Oronsay seal hunter was a man like him. Soon after 4000 BC, this whole habit of life came to a sudden end in what modern archaeology and genetic science have revealed to be the most radical revolution in the history of the temperate world. It may be that the sheer richness of life in the rock pools had allowed the population to grow and for pressures to come on their survival. The very fact that the limpets in the Oronsay middens are almost entirely the flatter form that grow on the lower shore and are to be reached only at low water spring tides may mean that the mound builders had cleared the more accessible limpets at the upper end of the tide and were squeezing the resource. Overfishing was already a factor at the end of the Mesolithic. For whatever reason, the new arrivals around 4000 BC swept all before them. The bone analysis that showed coastal Mesolithic people to have been entirely dependent on seafood has revealed their successors in the Neolithic to have ignored it just as completely. With no gradual transition, the products of the land were substituted for food from the sea and shore. The reason is not far to find. The archaeologist Geoffrey Bailey worked out that to provide enough protein for one man for a day would, if he ate nothing else, take 400 limpets, 700 oysters, or 1,400 cockles. The protein punch of a single cow was equivalent to 31,000 limpets, 52,000 oysters, and 157,000 cockles. Farming, the Neolithic revolution that brought domesticated animals, the use of pottery, land clearance, the growing of cereals, the building of farms and villages, was to be the future. New genetic evidence has shown that this Neolithic package did not come unaccompanied, but was brought to these Atlantic shores by a new race of people carrying with them the genes of their ancestors in the Near East and Southeastern Europe. That genetic inheritance, fused with other strains from the steppes of Central Asia, the source of the languages we speak, and the stories that have always been told here. They brought the animals with them. The closest relations of the early sheep that survived on St. Kilda are from Palestine and Syria. Even the deer on the Outer Hebrides have no genetic connection with deer on the mainland of Scotland or even Norway. Astonishingly, it looks as if they too were brought by boat in the Neolithic centuries from the mainland of Europe. The genetic origins of the dogs they brought with them were probably in Nepal or Mongolia. Very rapidly, the people stopped eating the products of the shore. Milk and cheese took their place, but it is not as if the food on the beach and the rocks disappeared. It was always there for the taking, even if people did not make use of it. Many archaeologists have concluded that a taboo was at work. Here, on the western and northern shores of Scotland, as in many other world cultures, the eating of fish came to be seen as degraded and even unclean. Reliance on farmed products had become the norm. That most radical shift in the human relationship to the natural did not come without hazards. All over the Neolithic world, a familiar pattern was repeated – Forests were cut down, land was cleared, crops planted, and stock animals bred. The new system provided a far stronger source of food than the Mesolithic reliance on nature. Children survived, and the populations grew, providing still more labour to clear the ground. From about 3000 BC, the climate worsened, colder, wetter, stormier. Inevitably, the Near Eastern cereal crops brought in by the Neolithic people started to fail. With increasing regularity, famine struck and death swept through the villages. It was a time, as the Ohio anthropologist Sean Downey and his colleagues have written, of rapid demographic growth, followed by periods of devastating societal instability. What were they to do? A brilliant analysis of the bodies of some Neolithic farmers in Orkney has shown that although shore protein does not appear in the bone collagen, which averages out food consumed over a lifetime, the fine layers of dentine laid down on a tooth, examined at thicknesses representing less than a single year, do reflect the food that was eaten while they were being made. These Neolithic teeth have revealed that from time to time the dominant land signature drops away, and at moments of crisis, people turned again towards the shore for famine food. Resorting to the shore for sustenance in an emergency remained the pattern throughout history. Seafood on the west coast of Scotland was eaten out of compulsion, not pleasure, and that alliance of crisis and the shore became the background to the most powerful of all the stories from these waters. It comes not from the infinite depths of the past, but from a quite identifiable moment, perhaps 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, when life here was threatened and in need of the most terrifying remedies. Of all the stories that turn on the turning of the tide, none is more gripping than the myth of Lady's Rock, which drifts in from the late 15th and early 16th centuries, but carries with it echoes of far earlier lives and other meanings. I have sailed down to Lady's Rock in my small 16-foot wooden lugger, launching from our beach at the head of the bay, and with a sunny day and a following tide and wind, taking no more than an hour or so to cover the 7 miles to where the rock and its beacon stand, mid-channel between Mull and Lismore. The rock itself is a disturbing and alluring thing. At the highest tides, seas break over it even on a still day, and when the rock clears above low water, its surface is as smooth as a turtleback, draped in weed, overwashed by the swells that come up and around the beacon tower. Before there was a light here, storms would have wrecked vessel after vessel on its low and lurking presence. Of the many, most have gone unrecorded, but the Rind of Wick, a schooner, can stand for them, totally destroyed here on the 8th of December 1851, during a heavy gale. It is feared, the clerk to Lloyd's List noted that week, that some other vessels have gone to pieces, as portions of wreck have been driven on shore on the islands of Kerrera and Lismore. Even at the lowest of tides, Lady's Rock never quite feels like an island. Common gulls and blackbacks sit on its dark surface, but it remains, when visible, part of the hidden world. As the tide fills into the Lynn of Morven to the north and up into the Sound of Mull, the cramming of those big and heavy streams through this narrow gateway between Mull and Lismore kicks the sea up into steep-walled peaks and overfalls. The water either side of here is, in places, 600 feet deep, but the channel through which the tide must push between Mull and Lady's Rock is less than half that, and between Lady's Rock and Lismore, at its shallowest, is only 80 feet deep. It is a constricted passage, and around the rock the sea breaks for no apparent reason, driven by its own constrained and hidden dynamics. The tidal stream, which in the Sound runs at 2 knots or so, accelerates here and with a following wind can run at 4 or 5 knots over the submerged rocks, often boiling up into weirdly unsettling slicks as the water meets and bubbles over those underwater projections and that surface mounds into low domes, spreading out from the centre, with in-sucking spirals at the margins. All around them the stiff, spiked and troubled seas are frightening in an open boat, when the confused, steep-walled waves can stand beside you, each peak level with the gunwale. I have never known it comfortable here, and it is always one of those anxious stretches you are happy to get through, whatever the weather. In a contrary wind, it can turn positively dangerous, with large boats swallowing holes opening up in the meeting of the tides. The Admiralty charts still carry a warning for small vessels here as a place to avoid in fierce weather. In a story told by Norman MacLeod, Minister of Morven in the 19th century, this part of the tideway was called the Dirks, from the figure of the waves which rose on every side, tossing their sharp heads in the sky. It is the Sea of Knives. Whoe'er has raised the sail by Mull's dark coast has heard this evening's tale, Walter Scott wrote in 1810, as his prologue to a play he had put on in Edinburgh, written by his friend Joanna Bailey, and with the principals acted by Mr. and Mrs. Siddons. The plaided boatman, resting on his oar, points to the fatal rock amid the roar of whitening waves. This is the place around which the story has gathered. There is, first, what feels like an applied historical frame. A mile and a half to the west of the rock is the tall grey bulk of Dewart Castle, high on a crag overlooking the entrance to the Sound. It was built in parts and in stages in the 14th, 15th and 16th centuries, and restored with a romantic silhouette in the early 1900s. For at least 500 years, it has been the headquarters of Clan MacLean. At some time, perhaps in the late 1490s, but all documents are uncertain, a marriage was arranged between the heir to the chief of the MacLeans in Dewart and the increasingly powerful Campbells, Earls of Argyll, who were at various times both their rivals and their allies. Argyll's daughter, called in different versions either Catherine, Janet or Elizabeth, was given in marriage to Lachlan MacLean, chief of his clan, the Laird of Dewart. Stories of this Lachlan, his name, shared by many MacLeans, means Norseman in Gaelic, are told even now on Mull as a man with at least six wives or mistresses, the only bad chief of Clan MacLean. Two carved slabs on the ground outside the southeast corner of Pennygown Chapel, near Sallon on Mull, are pointed out as the graves of this chief and one of his wives. Both, it is said, were witches, burning live cats when their squalling summoned the devil. Such wickedness could not be buried in hallowed ground, and the two of them remain outside the church. Argyll's daughter was brought to Dewart from her father's castle at Inverary on Loch Fyne. The story now riffles into different versions. In some, she had a lover at home who came with her disguised as a monk. He was to aid her plan to steal the land of the MacLeans and give it to her brother, heir to the Earl of Argyll. In another, when she came to MacLean's bed, she found beside him the sword he always slept with. She objected to sharing a bed with a sword, and he fell first into a rage and then to plotting against her. In some versions of the story, the union between this MacLean and the Campbell girl was barren. In others, she bore him a son, but the MacLean clan as a whole, in particular the chief's own foster brothers, were hostile to her. They came to him and said they would desert him, and the clan would be broken if they could not put his wife and son to death, so that the blood of the Campbells might not succeed to the inheritance of MacLean. One version says she tried to poison him. In another, the chief had entertained a violent passion for a young daughter of a vassal chieftain, MacLean of Treshnish, on the far side of Mull, and the only hope he had of obtaining her was by getting rid of his present lady. The chief resisted his clansmen, fearing the power and vengeance of Argyll, but at length gave way, fearful for his own life. The only condition he imposed was that no blood should be shed. the better to accomplish his end and to lull suspicion on the eve of his infamous attempt, he for some time bestowed more than his usual attentions on his unsuspecting victim, and proposed that on a certain evening they should make an excursion on the water in the neighbourhood of Dewart Castle. To this his confiding lady consented, and on the proposed evening he had one of his galleys in readiness, manned by a few tools whom he had admitted into his secret. They embarked and proceeded towards a solitary rock, distant about 2 miles eastward of Dewart Castle, and only visible at half-tide, where he left her in the anticipation that the tide, now rapidly rising, would soon sweep her away for ever from his sight. She was to die in the sea, but as she was about to drown on her rock, she saw a boat in the channel. The water was as high as her breast, so that the boatmen at first mistook her for a large bird. In some versions, the boat was full of her own Campbells, one of them, her foster father, who had looked after her as a girl and recognised her cry. In other versions, the origins of the people in the boat are scattered across this loch and land interlace of the West Highlands, either from Lismore or Loch Don in Mull, from Knapdale further south on the mainland, or from Tainish on Loch Sween. In several of the versions, she shelters for a while in a corn mill, which is later given to her rescuers, before she comes at last to the castle of her father at Inverary. Argyll hid his daughter, waiting for news from Mull. MacLean sent a solemn account of her death, and soon came himself to Inverary with his clan, all in mourning. In one version, the would-be murderer brought with him a coffin filled with turf, and with great solemnity, either had it interred at Inverary or set in a chamber there to await its burial. Argyll received him with all honour. A feast was served in the hall. Everyone took his place, while a seat was left empty on the right hand of Argyll. As they ate, the door opened, and Catherine MacLean entered, superbly dressed, to take her place beside them. MacLean stood for a moment aghast, when the servants and retainers, making a lane for him to pass through the hall to the gate of the castle, the Earl's son, the Lord of Lorne, followed him, and slew him as he fled. In another version, the crafty and suspicious chief had taken such precaution in arming himself and his followers as to render it dangerous to attempt the summary punishment he so justly merited, and the Campbells allowed him to escape. Only many years later was he murdered in his bed in Edinburgh by his wife's brother, Campbell of Calder, who did not trouble to remove his knife from its scabbard, but pushed it whole and sheathed into the sleeping man's heart. What to make of this tale? It haunts the whole stretch of the Sound from Dewart up to our own bay. I never see the tall beacon on the rock or its light flashing solemnly at night without it coming to mind. But what is it? A vivid and brutal incident from a lawless time in the history of the West Highlands? An exciting drama of the tidal landscape, to which a string of late 18th and early 19th century writers were drawn for its Gothic ingredients? Or something deeper and older than that? Push beyond the late medieval surface, first, into MacLean of Dewart himself. His nickname, Catanach, means the wild one, the shaggy or hairy one. Hairiness is long associated, in the widespread of Indo-European myth, with a kind of transgressive potency. It marks a man out in the economy of these stories as bestial, shamanistic, even demonic, a signal that the tale is dealing with more than the human. Then the woman, Elizabeth or Janet or Catherine Campbell. She is an outsider who brings threat in her wake. The MacLean clansmen do not trust her, nor does Catanach himself, who greets her in his bed with a sword. For a sword to be lying between lovers or potential lovers is a symbol of chastity in many Irish and Scandinavian stories. Tristan and Isolde in the Breton and Welsh myths on which Wagner drew are found by King Mark of Cornwall to be sleeping with a sword between them as a sign and symbol of their purity. Here, though, the sword is more potent than that. The presence of violence and hostility deep in the place where there should be sexual union. Catherine Campbell seems to have poison about her, ready either to poison the pure MacLean blood with the admixture of her own Campbell blood, or, more directly, to poison Catanach himself. Whichever way she turns, she is toxic, either in the barrenness of her marriage to MacLean or in conceiving a child. She also is a witch, with powers of evil beyond ordinary choosing, and it is against those powers that Catanach's sword lies in the bed. And so, it seems, Catherine Campbell must be given to the sea. The community of clansmen demand it. No blood must be spilled. The sea itself must have her whole. Her body must go into it up to her middle, to breast and neck, so that she loses the appearance of humanity and becomes like a wild bird, returning, as a witch often will, to her animal form. She must be executed by drowning as an offering to the tide. The oldest rites of the Indo-European peoples, from Scandinavia to the Indus, stretching back into the pre-literate centuries before 2000 BC, finds religion connected to a tripartite cluster of sacrifice, feasting, and the telling of tales. Those three elements are all in play here, but there is something more precise too. Among the ancient Gauls and in pagan Germanic tribes, there was a three-part system of punishment by which an offence against a priest or governing authority was subject to hanging, against the warrior code, to burning or execution by the sword. The fertility gods, who presided over earth and generation, the growing of food and the survival of humanity, were to be satisfied only with death by drowning. Echoes of this story are found first of all in the widespread Andromeda myth, one of the great templates of sacrifice and rescue to have migrated across centuries and worlds. In the myth, a queen boasts that her daughter is more beautiful than the sea nymphs who live with Poseidon. They insist that the sea god avenge this unforgivable human hubris. He agrees and punishes the queen by devastating the land with disastrous floods, sending a terrible sea monster to devour every human and beast in his path. The people tell the king that the land can be saved only by the sacrifice of the king's daughter, Andromeda. The king is uncertain and delays, but eventually gives in to the demands of the people. Andromeda is taken to a rock by the sea's edge, where she will drown to appease the rage of Poseidon. The young Perseus then appears, armed and in flight. He cuts off the sea monster's head with a magical curved sword. Andromeda is set free, and he sweeps her off to marry her. Andromeda is the bride of death, led out to the seashore at night, and left there to keep the devastation of the human world at bay. She is to be killed to ensure the survival of others. This legend is told by Hesiod, Homer, Euripides, Pliny, and Ovid, and in every one the vital spirit at the heart of the tale is arrogance, the daring of mortals to assume they can be equal to the gods, neglecting the primacy of the great and dominating forces in the world. A lord, a rock, the sea, woman, death, and rescue. The connection to that famous myth is clear enough, but the lady's rock story holds on to some darker and more essential elements that have been sanitized away from the classical story. Sacrificial killing is the basic experience of the sacred. The great mythographer, anthropologist, and Greek scholar Walter Burkert wrote, "It is one of humanity's most powerful and paradoxical acts of connection with the natural world, dependent on a recognition of the reciprocal nature of existence. We must live in the frame of mutuality. To give is to expect to receive. To receive is to expect to give in return. Sacrifice is an act of killing that simultaneously guarantees the perpetuation of life and food, a two-sided act compressing into one highly charged moment, the encounter with death and the will to live. To sacrifice is to recognize flux and return, to acknowledge the tidal nature of reality. These are deep waters, but ones which were long fundamental to the pre-modern world. Sacrifice is everywhere, in ancient China, in the Proto-Indo-Europeans of Central Asia, in pre-Columbian America, in Egypt, with the Phoenicians, the Babylonians, Persians, Greeks, Etruscans, Romans, and, symbolized and spiritualized, in the central rituals of Christianity. The killing is always followed by feasting, a reassertion of the social fabric after a hole has been cut in it with the knife, the reward, in some sense, for which the sacrifice has been made. Life is guaranteed by these deaths, and so the value of the life that is desired is measured by the value of the creature that is killed for it. The most precious lives, the best that can be found, must be the chosen victims. The sacrifice of young women is found all over the world, from Asia to Polynesia. In America, the Hurons and Algonquins sacrificed a virgin before fishing. In Mexico, young women were killed before the harvest. In many places, animals were substituted in the sacrifice. In Stone Age Germany, young does in springtime, after being killed and weighed down with rocks, were pushed into the depths of pools where archaeologists have found their remains surrounded by the waiting stones. In Genesis, Abraham is required by God to kill his son, Isaac. Isaac's place is taken at the last moment by a ram. Iphigenia in Greek mythology is magically replaced by a deer before her father kills her as a sacrifice to allow the Greek fleet to sail to Troy. In Greece more generally, a goat was substituted if the sacrifice was to Artemis, the goddess of hunting, if to Demeter, the mother of fertility, by a pig. These stories hinge on the interchangeability of the young innocent animal with the young innocent person, symptomatic of a moral retraction from the horror of killing people. It may seem as if these human practices are buried too deep in the past, still to be playing in stories that are now located no more than 10 or 12 generations ago, but intriguing elements of them were to be found in tales told on the west coast of Scotland in the 17th and 18th centuries, and repeated to folklorists by old men and women who remembered them in Victorian Britain. In about 1865, the Reverend Malcolm MacPhail, a schoolmaster in Lewis in the Outer Hebrides, recorded a story from the Atlantic shores of the island in which a goat or sheep was brought to the seashore where the fishermen were in the habit of landing their fish. Then the oldest fisherman in the district, revered alike for his age and seamanship, was appointed Pontifex Maximus to conduct and preside at the public sacrifice. The temporary priest now led the victim to the place appointed for the sacrificial rite, and this was so near the edge of the sea that any of the blood spilt would fall into the water. The aged seaman, conscious of the solemnity and dignity of his position, reverently uncovered his hoary head and, on bended knees, slew the victim by cutting off its head. With scrupulous care, the blood was caught in a boat's bailer. When the blood had ceased to flow, he waded into the sea and there poured it out to him whom he considered the ruler of the deep and its numerous inhabitants. He then turned to the carcass of the victim and divided it into as many portions as there were paupers in the district, sending a piece to each, for it was touched by no one else. This ceremony, called the beheading, had last been performed, MacPhail thought, in about 1805. Every ingredient of the ancient rite is here: the young victim, no blood to be spilled, the sacrificial animal brought to the sea edge, the prayer for plenty, and a version of the feast that followed the killing, the distribution of meat to those in hunger. MacPhail recorded another equivalent ritual from Lewis, first described by Martin Martin at the very beginning of the 18th century, which retained other aspects of the ancient rite. In springtime, the women of the township collected some grains, which they dried and ground, and used to brew some ale. As soon as it was ready, it was conveyed in libatory vases, Kragans to the seashore, where, wading knee-deep, they poured it into the sea, at the same time ejaculating, "Shawnee, Shawnee, Huginye faldis brucha umbliena acus vierie shinye baruche luna yutsa in abliena," i.e., "Sonny, Sonny, send us plenty of seaware, seaweed to be used as manure this year, and we will give thee more ale next year." Who or what Sonny was remains uncertain. The name may be a reference to John the Baptist, or perhaps a descendant of Sorn, the mythical vessel in which the mead of poetry was kept, obtained from the dwarves by marooning them on tidal rock until they handed it over, or the name simply of a Celtic sea god. A letter written by the minister of Ness at the northern tip of Lewis in 1700 describes some heathenish and superstitious rites used in the isle, adding a more salacious element. At the ceremonies, the people of Lewis who gathered for the sacrifice to the sea kindled great fires all the night over and spent the whole night in piping, singing profane songs, dancing and whoring too, that seldom I heard of these meetings when I was a child, but I heard also of such and such persons falling in fornication or adultery at such occasions, and this made a sport of. Sacrifice, the sea margin, sexuality, fertility, communality, violence and transgression. These are also the underconditions of the lady's rock story. They persisted in Lewis, even if driven to secrecy and disapproved of by the church, in a way that had vanished earlier from the lands around the Sound of Mull and the Firth of Lorne. Even so, Alexander Carmichael, the great mid-19th-century folklorist from Lismore, met someone who had witnessed it in Iona at the western end of Mull. Deep in the night on the Wednesday before Easter, Carmichael wrote, "People in maritime districts made offerings of mead, ale, or gruel to the god of the sea. As the day merged from Wednesday to Thursday, a man walked to the waist into the sea and poured out whatever offering had been prepared, chanting, 'A ye namara curtuer untarun, hun tachir untalav, hun balki yunye bieg.' O god of the sea, put weed in the drawing wave to enrich the ground, to shower on us food." Those behind the offerer took up the chant and wafted it along the seashore on the midnight air, the darkness of night and the rolling of the waves making the scene weird and impressive. How to relate this casting of the grain into the sea, the stuff of survival, with the blood sacrifice, the act of the knife? Walter Burkert reconstructed the core moment of an inherited sacrificial ritual. The virgin, an untouched girl, led the way to the place of sacrifice, carrying a basket filled with barley grains, the most ancient agricultural product. Just before the moment of killing, the attendants reached into the basket, took handfuls of grain and flung them away onto the sacrificial animal, the altar, or a sacrificial pit in the earth. Hidden beneath the grain in the basket was the knife which now lay uncovered. Soon came the death blow. The women raised a piercing scream, whether in fear or triumph or both. The blood flowing out was treated with special care. It was not to spill onto the ground, but was reserved for the altar or pit, on land, or, as here, for the sea itself, which must be seen to fill with the blood. Is that what in the deep past would have been witnessed here, on the rock, awash between Duett and Lismore, in times that are recorded in no other way than in the distorted story of Catherine MacLean and her husband? It seems to be a story that reaches into the beginnings of our relationship to the natural world, a myth from a much deeper level of human experience and consciousness than the 16th century, a way of addressing the realities of life and survival in a place where the tides of well-being and trouble have always swept across the human landscape, a story that dramatizes, in remembered ritual, the structure of a human ecology in a world tense with hunger, danger, and the need to avert them. It also can be seen to represent the most modern and urgent myth of all, the assumption that we do not need to take into account the demands of the world around us, that we are equal in our willfulness to its power, that we are better than the sea nymphs. The world around us will take its vengeance whether we like it or not, and so we must make our sacrifices to it, giving the most beautiful and treasured and life-giving things we have to the iron forces of existence. That is the instruction behind this tale, obeisance in front of the world's inflexible demand. What of the strange non-funeral banquet at Inverary? It is clearly a version of the post-sacrifice feast, but guilt-ridden rather than triumphant, aware more of the wickedness of the act than of its efficacy for those who had killed and surrendered the woman. Even in older myth, these two elements are in fierce tension. How can the provision of food be worth the death of a young woman? Surely such a sacrifice is a crime. Is the demand that fierce that the best of us must die for it? Those questions lie behind the Isaac story, the Iphigenia story, and all the stories in which the human being is saved and the animal sacrificed in its place. But the Lady's Rock story straddles these categories. As far as the MacLeans are concerned, she is dead. She must be dead for the good of the clan, and they fill her coffin with turf from their own ground. Her killing is a gift to the gods. For the Campbells, she has survived and deserves to survive. Her killing is barbaric and a crime. And so she comes like a ghost or an avenging angel to the feast, the embodiment of guilt for the MacLeans. Justification for all the killing the Campbells will now enact, slaughtering and reducing the MacLeans for centuries to come. MacLean guilt over her death will allow the Campbells to do what they want for as long as they must. War can be vengeance for the maiden's death, Walter Burkert wrote of a pervasive pattern in Greek myth, and for those communities that used the woman's death as an excuse for subsequent killing, she often returned symbolically and ritually restored as the focus for a company of youths. Here, then, is Catherine Campbell at the Inverary feast, transmuted into a kind of presiding goddess of innocence and power, back from the dead, perfect and inspiring, leading the Campbells to their future career of invasion, destruction, and dominance. It may be curious that such an ancient tale and set of memories should be locked quite so firmly to the story of a MacLean chieftain at the beginning of the 16th century. But there is precedence in the Highlands for that kind of drift, the migrating of a story from the distant and mythic past to a historical moment. In recent and local memory, recorded as late as the 1960s, the ruins of several buildings at Bunrannock to the east of Pitlochry were known to be the remains of a village that was burned down in 1746, as a reprisal by government forces against the people there who had risen in rebellion with the Jacobites. Rannoch was famous as a wild place, its habits said to be outside the confines of a civilized society, the people described by their hostile minister in 1795 as previously living in an uncivilized, barbarous state under no check or restraint of laws, in huts that could only be entered on hands and knees, with no beds, with people lying on the ground with a single blanket and subsisting on very little, bleeding their cattle to gain sustenance. In a remarkable piece of detective work by Gavin McGregor, the Glasgow University archaeologist, this story has turned out to be untrue, or at least to be a conflation of truth and untruth, of distant past and more recent memory. Early maps showed there was no settlement at Bunrannoch in 1746. There were no houses to house rebels or suffer vengeful atrocity. Dr. McGregor had the ruins of two of the buildings examined, and the excavators found that they had indeed been burned, with charcoal from some hazel sticks within the walls and carbonized oats in a pit in one of the floors. He had these fragments carbon dated. They had been burned at some time between AD 660 and AD 940. The houses at Bunranak had been destroyed 1,000 years earlier than the stories of Hanoverian vengeance. The memory of the terrifying destruction had been retained throughout the Middle Ages, and only in the 19th and 20th centuries been conflated with other atrocities performed by the Campbell forces in 1746. The tradition, MacGregor wrote, remembered a number of truths. Places and actions are precisely recalled, but the time at which they occurred is as elastic as a vision. Like the killing at Lady's Rock, the burning of Bunranak floats somewhere only in the stream of the remembered past. I have sailed back home alone at night through these blood-soaked waters, with a warm wind blowing in from the southeast. On the cliffs the golden eagles were nesting as they have done these last few thousand years, and the sea trout beneath me were quietly making their way towards the waters of their burns. The ghosts of Catherine Campbell and her many predecessors were not far away. The tide turned in my direction, and the summer sea was mildness itself, a surface rippled with waves so small they were like the ribbed skin of an estuary sand. Only in the distant west, over the hills in Mull, was there any paleness in the sky. The lights winked around me, a silent, concerted night harmony. The big lighthouse on Lismore, white once every 10 seconds, the light on the Grey Islands, white once every 3 seconds, the beacon on Lady's Rock, also white, once every 6 seconds. In a mathematical dance they came together every half minute before diverging again. The sectored light on Ardtornish Point was steady ahead, white for the channel, green and red for the shoals and rocks on either side, and the lights in the windows of our own house at the head of the bay showed apricot yellow in the blue of the dark, the glow of home. I was listening to the surface of the sea running and bumping against the hull, looking at the three-part stripe of the wake behind me. I fixed the tiller to the transom and went forward. Leaning over the bow, putting my head down there where the water surged and broke around the stempost, this is what they talked about in the sagas, the sea absorbing you, taking you up, making you its own, quietly telling you and anyone like you that this was its kingdom and here, without challenge, its government.